fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The world of 911 emergency dispatching is brutally diverse. One minute you can be talking with someone about parking violations.
What's the process we are to take to have people towed? Because it's actually delaying the mail.
And then all hell can break loose. Then the rest of the day is crazy. We could have murders.
Hill County 911, what's your emergency?
I just killed my children.
Home invasions.
He's in my house. I shot him.
You shot him?
He was coming up towards me and I shot him.
Natural disasters.
Tornadoes need to guide us. I'm buried under a bomb to roll my life.
Even bombings. My show, Music City 911, will put you in the dispatcher's chair, put you ear to ear with the callers and responders, and keep you on edge from start to finish. I hope to both educate and entertain, as I'm a 911 dispatcher with over 20 years experience. And just like dispatching, every episode is different from the last. Music City 911. Real 911 calls, real 911 dispatchers. Available to listen to on any podcast app.
I have a couple of very special guests with me today, Melissa and Christy from the podcast Buried Motives. Melissa, Christy, and I started our podcast at the same time, so as an anniversary gift to ourselves, we like to bring each other onto our shows and just give you all an idea of what us Alberta-based podcasters are doing and how we're doing it. And today, Melissa and Christy are bringing us the murder of Taylor Van Diest. You can find Buried Motives wherever you get your podcasts, and I highly recommend adding them to your playlist. They do very good research, and they always have some very good victim-first commentary on the cases that they cover.
I don't remember anything after I left the house until I got to jail.
The law didn't come into my mind. I wasn't caring about the law. I was dealing with dead children on my hands. Fuck the law. I'm in trouble, man. My kids are dead.
But once I lied, I continued to lie. Yes, sir.
Why?
You know, oh, what a tangled web we weave. But once I told a lie, I had to keep lying.
Like, what kind of person would do something like that?
I know.
I'm asking, what kind of person do you think would do something like that?
Obviously, not a good person.
I know it's been a while. It's been 2 years since we've done a collab, just us together.
I think that's one of my favorite things now about podcasting in the last couple of years is getting to know other podcasters.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's been a lot of fun. And I don't know, just to feel like you're almost like a contemporary. I don't know. I always feel like I'm kind of an imposter in the space sometimes. And so it's really nice when somebody says, oh yeah, no, I've heard of you or whatever. I'm like, oh really? Like, it's always surprising.
Yeah. It's nice that it's a community. Like, yeah. There's enough listeners for all of us to share, which is great. And yeah, so we can all support each other and help each other.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately enough stories to go around.
Yeah. Even if there was not another murder committed ever again, we still wouldn't run out.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
It is sad. Yeah. Well, and there's been, just in the years that we've been doing it, there's been lots more.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Kim. We're excited be doing another collab. And today I thought we would go in and share a case that we've previously done on Halloween.
We often try to cover cases that go with what's happening at that time of the year.
So this case stood out to me, Kim, because there were a lot of similarities between the victim's interests and Christie's. She loved Halloween and RuPaul's Drag Race, and she loved life and was always up for a little bit of fun. So she reminded me so much of Christie that I was like, oh, I need to cover this case. She was just so sweet and the best kind of friend for those around her.
But do you love Halloween, like scary Halloween, or the like the cute Halloween?
All of it. I love everything about Halloween. All of From it. The cute little pink ghosts right down to the horror films.
Do you watch, like, do you sit down and you're like, that's your time, or you're like, I'm gonna watch my scary movies?
I do, but Melissa doesn't.
No.
I've had to drag her to a couple of scary movies or have her watch them with me, but that doesn't happen very often. And most of the time she has her eyes closed.
Yes. Oh. I like the more cute Halloween stuff.
And yet you do true crime.
It's true. Yep. I freak myself out all the time.
Even in her research sometimes.
Yep.
She's got to go around and lock the doors after.
But that's why I have Christy. She gets me through so many movies and so many cases. And that's what Taylor, that was kind of like the friend that Taylor was to her friends too. Unfortunately, she was taken much too early by the dirtbag Matthew Forrester. So Matthew Stephen Forrester was raised by his father, Stephen Roy Forrester, in the interior southern region of British Columbia, Canada. It's known as the Okanagan, and it is a very pretty area of Canada. And it's very popular in the summer because of all of its warm lakes and picturesque scenery. And in recent years, it's become really popular in the fall for its wine tours. We were just there and it is amazing.
I do love the Okanagan there, like the lakes and stuff like that. I don't know that I do the wine tours, but it's just, BC is just such a beautiful province. Like everything about it is just amazing.
It really is. It's funny how quickly that climate changes as you head across Canada. It's like its own little oasis.
It is very pretty there. So while I was doing this research, from the publicly accessible information, there wasn't very much mentioned about Matt's mother. I believe she exited his life in his preschool or early elementary years, because he does have a full sister that's about 4 years younger than him. While I couldn't ascertain why his mom exited the picture, I think it's really interesting in light of the rage that he later shows against women in his later life. But that's all just a speculation. Yep. I could have it wrong, but that's what I'm thinking. It's really interesting to me. There are some brief mentions of his mother in the media outlets attending his trial, but I'm pretty sure that those are actually referring to his stepmom, who was quite supportive to him throughout the trial. Matthew and his sister Stephanie were raised by their father, which again I find interesting because his father was not a great example. Stephen struggled with his own addictions and propensity for breaking the law. He had been known to local police since he was a teen himself when he had stolen a car at the age of 15. Throughout the years, Stephen would be convicted of numerous offenses like possession of drugs, restricted weapons, and escaping custody. He worked at random jobs, supporting his children, until he eventually married a woman named Deborah. And things seemed to turn around for him then. At least he stopped piling up the criminal offenses. They bought a home in Cherryville, BC, a small rural community in the North Okanagan. And Deborah stayed home with the kids. Cherryville, if its name doesn't already conjure up an image, is a quaint town. In 2011, there were barely over 600 people that lived there full time. And it was a place where everyone knew everyone. The town is picturesque among the foothills of the mountains surrounded by the crystal blue lakes. Deborah had her own son, Michael, and he was a little bit older than Matt and his sister. But from all reports I read, it seemed like they all got along and bonded really well, especially the two boys. So much so that Mike, with the help of Stephanie, his younger sister, would be the ones that would get Matt to confess later. There were some reports that said he was a half-brother and some said stepbrother, but I'm pretty sure that he was the stepbrother, that there was no biological relationship between the two of them.
It's lucky that they got along so well, because yeah. Sometimes when you blend a family, that doesn't always happen.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true, but these two, they seem to bond really, really well. As a young child, it seemed like Matt struggled, and at the age of 14, started drinking pretty heavily, and it soon escalated to smoking marijuana. As a teen, he had problems with impulse control and anger, which with the combination of drugs and alcohol is never a good mix. Matt developed an attitude of taking what he wanted, just like his father had displayed when he had stolen a car. He did graduate from Charles Bloom Secondary School in Lumbee, BC in 2004, but it was pretty clear that he was following quite closely in his father's footsteps, heading straight for disastrous outcomes. In the fall, after graduating high school with no real purpose, the now 18-year-old Matt decided that one of the things that he would like to pursue was his friend's older sister. In true dirtbag fashion, he couldn't just ask her out on a date, though. That would give her the opportunity to say no. Matt had been fantasizing about this girl, but he felt he didn't have a chance with her. He would later say that he felt, quote, things just wouldn't work out between them. Matt decides, with the help of some liquid courage, that the best course of action would be to sneak into her bedroom wearing a mask.
Yeah, that always gets the girls. Like, that's no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, straight to our hearts that way.
Yeah exactly. Gross.
Yeah, a dirtbag right from the start.
Such a weasel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gross. It sounds like the beginnings of like what would later turn into like an incel, if he feels like, you know, we don't want to give girls the opportunity to say no, because, you know, how could somebody dare say no to me? It's just gross.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it does continue along that path, because Matt very rarely will give a woman the opportunity to say no. On that morning, October 19th, 2004, around 8:30 a.m., Matt snuck into his friend's sister's bedroom wearing a mask and armed with a BB gun. He woke up 19-year-old Callie Paul banging her head against the bedroom wall, splitting her head wide open.
Oh,
geez.
With her dazed and confused, Matt demands that she follow him out of the bedroom. When they were out in the hallway, Callie fell. She was bleeding profusely from her head and she had lost her balance. She demanded to know if Matt intended to use the gun he was carrying to shoot her. He sinisterly told her no, he just wanted her. That's when she started to scream. She thought she was going to pass out, and she was probably terrified of what was going to happen if she did pass out. So she just kept on screaming. Her screams luckily scared Matt off, and he fled the house that morning. Callie was confident, though, that she knew who her attacker was, despite the mask that Matt had worn. Remember, they're in this town of only 600 people in all age groups. So you're going to know the ones close to your age, especially if they're hanging out with your younger brother.
Yeah, I'm sure she had been around him many times before.
Yeah, well, so she knew.
Spoke too, right? So she would have heard his voice.
Yeah, she knew right away who it was. And she went straight to the police with her parents and reported the attack and identified Matt as her attacker. The Lumbee RCMP officers brought Matt in for questioning, along with Stephen, who insisted that he come along with his son. Which, I'm not surprised. I think if my kid was pulled in for questioning to the RCMP office, I would go along too.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Even without that tumultuous relationship with authority that Stephen had, I think most parents would go along. But how far would you go to protect your child? Most, I think, would not extend that protection to what Stephen does next. During the interview, he provides an alibi for Matt, saying that he was at home the whole time of the attack, that Stephen saw Matt wake up at his house at 9 a.m., that he was there the whole time.
That's ridiculous. Yeah,
it is. And I know there are some people that wanted to give Stephen the benefit of the doubt, that maybe he was just tricked by Matt. Maybe he didn't see him sneak back into the house. Maybe he did just see him coming out of his bedroom. But all of those people would be sorely mistaken, because this sad pattern will repeat itself. This dirtbag dad continues to lie for his dirtbag son.
Which means he's enabling him to continue to do these horrific things.
Yeah.
Knowingly.
Well, he doesn't have a lot of respect for authority as it is, so he's just kind of like, well, no, I'm, yeah, he's just covering up. Yeah, he's, yeah, another dirtbag.
That's right. With what police believe to be a solid alibi, they move on to look for other suspects. Of course, they wouldn't find any, because Matt really was their guy. The case remained unsolved, with Callie and her family living in terror, not ever even feeling safe in their own home. With
They had to see this guy at the grocery store, and like, because he's just out and about. And...
Yeah.
In close proximity to each other.
Mm-hmm. They knew it was him, and he's just hanging around in town.
Mm-hmm. And they knew that his dad was going to bail him out, that his dad wasn't even going to stop him.
And that's what I mean. They lived in terror.
Yeah, he would.
Matt, with his get out of free jail card provided by his daddy's alibi, didn't take the opportunity to get help for his growing addiction to control women. Instead, he just fans the flames. Just 8 months later, he entered the Garden of Eden Escort Agency in Kelowna, BC on April 12, 2005. Kelowna is the biggest city around Cherryville. It's about an hour and a half away. Posing as a potential client, he encourages an employee at the establishment to give him a tour of the building. Once he had her upstairs in a secluded area, he grabbed her by the ponytail and forced her to the ground. This time, he used a knife to subdue his victim and promised that he wouldn't hurt her if she performed oral sex on him. He forces her by holding the knife to her throat. Next, he forced her onto her stomach on one of the massage tables, bound her hands with duct tape, and sodomized her.
Ugh.
Yeah. He's just out of control. When he was done, he fled the scene. This brave woman, whose name was protected, fought her way free with the help of a woman who was next door and went to the police and reported the rape, which is just so strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So many go unreported.
Mm-hmm. But she reported it, which is so sad in Matt's history, is that these women are reporting him. But again, despite collecting DNA evidence, the police were unable to make a connection between the attack and Matt. He just faded into the background, but he didn't go too far. Matt moved out of his family's home and settled in a slightly larger town of Lumbee, BC, about 20 minutes west of Terryville and 25 minutes east of Vernon, nestled right in the middle of both. I find it hard to believe that there are not more women that Matt attacked and violated. Sexual predators rarely de-escalate or stop without being forced to.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like he was like just, what's the word I'm looking for? Just like he's not even trying to like hide what he's doing. Like he's just brazen. That's the word I was looking for. It's brazen. Like he's just arrogant.
He's arrogant. And with each attack, it seemed like he was escalating.
That he can just walk around town, and if he sees an opportunity, he's going to take it.
Right. And the amount of times that he doesn't get caught just makes him more brazen. It gives him more confidence that he's not going to get caught, especially when he's got daddy in his back pocket.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think it's clear from several of his statements that he made after the fact that he was spiraling out of control at this time, especially when it came to his sexual fantasies. There are several times that he refers to being compelled to carry out these fantasies in his mind, saying that, quote, it's like another person took over me. There could very well be other victims. But Matt would not be linked to any other crimes until the fateful Halloween night in 2011 when he met Taylor Van Deest in Armstrong, BC. Armstrong is a little town in Canada made famous for its cheese, and it's about 20 minutes north of Vernon. If you were to draw a map of this dirtbag's attacks, it would literally draw a circle around his home. It is a little elongated, but he did not travel far to find his victims, which just points out his impulsiveness and his brazenness.
Yeah, and he's not even targeting vulnerable populations. Like he's just targeting like you're vulnerable just for being a female around this guy.
Yeah, he would describe it that he would just see somebody and he would feel this urge to attack. He just needed them for himself. Unfortunately, Taylor Van Deest was that person. She was 18 years old. She had just graduated from Pleasant Valley Secondary School. She seemed like the sweetest, good-hearted girl. Halloween was her absolute favorite holiday, just like Christy. Although Taylor was 18 and recognized that she was what most people would think was too old to go trick-or-treating, she just couldn't help herself, and she talked a few of her friends into going out with her.
I love that. You're never too old.
Yeah. You're never too old. As long as you wear a costume, you are never too old to go trick-or-treating.
No, oh, I love it when teenagers come to my house.
Yeah, especially when you're trick-or-treating, not pulling pranks or like egging houses. But if you're honestly into the trick-or-treating, that is awesome.
Truthfully, I would still go if I could get away with it. I'm pretty short. If I had a costume with a mask, maybe I could.
You could totally
I don't have kids young enough to go either. So I don't get to go. I just have to watch. I get to watch the kids though. And we always try to scare them. We do. We go a little overboard maybe with our Halloween decorations.
Oh, I love that, Kim.
So fun. So Taylor had talked a few of her friends into going. She couldn't quite talk Colton, her boyfriend, into going, or her sister, Christy. They weren't ones that she can convince, but she did talk her other friends, Zoe and Clay, into going out with her. They all agreed that it would be their last Halloween of trick-or-treating before they all moved away and continued on with their adult lives. They were all moving on to different schools and different vocations. And so this was their big last hurrah, they felt. It was the first time that Taylor and her sister had ever spent Halloween apart because they were twins.
Right.
Yeah. Before choosing her costume, Taylor polled social media for opinions of her choices. She had narrowed them down to a woodland fairy or a zombie, but she was having trouble deciding for herself. In the end, her love of The Walking Dead TV show won out, and she spent the afternoon getting ready. She put on her costume of jeans and a white shirt, covered with a loose purple shirt that was torn artistically and had fake blood applied in all the right places. While texting back and forth with her friends, making plans, she did her makeup just right, giving her the eerie look of death with open, gaping wounds all over. Taylor sent a text that evening that her friend Zoe was on her way and that together they would meet up and meet at Clay's house around 6 p.m. After playfully texting her boyfriend Clayton about sharing her loot when she got back that night, Taylor left her house around 5:45 p.m., right after she had her mom take a picture in her costume. She was obviously proud of her handiwork, and she really did look awesome. Her makeup job was amazing. Her mom said goodbye and told her to stay safe, just like she always did. It was a short distance between Taylor and Clay's house. To this day, no one really knows why she didn't just wait for her friend Zoe to head over to Clay's house, but for some reason, she struck out on her own. Maybe thinking that she would just meet Zoe along the way, or maybe she was just so excited to start collecting candy and wanted to get started. Taylor walked a path that was well known to her and took a shortcut that was used by a lot of people between Rosedale Ave and Pleasant Valley Road along the train tracks, just as the sun was setting low on the horizon. And it's lined by people's yards that back onto the railroad tracks. At the time, it wasn't an official walking path. The grass and the bushes was longer, but the path was well-worn. It was traveled by a lot of people. At 6:02, Taylor sent her boyfriend a message of, quote, being creeped. This was Taylor's wording that the couple had used before when someone was checking them out. But what was unusual about this text was that it was misspelt, and it gave the impression that it was being typed in a hurry. Taylor had written, quote, C-R-R-E-P-E-D, doubling the R and writing only a singular E. Taylor was a meticulous speller, even when it came to texting. Unfortunately, this was only picked up on later when Taylor did not meet up with her friends. When Taylor didn't show up at Clay's house, at first they thought she was just running late, but even that was unlike her. It didn't take long before they began to get worried. Taylor was not answering any text. Again, very unusual behavior for her. She was always prompt to reply.
This also tells us that she was really afraid when all of this was going down by sending that text.
Mm-hmm. Her spidey senses were up. She knew something was out there to get her.
Yeah, the text is creepy in itself. That,
yeah.
I hate last text messages. Those are the worst.
Yeah.
Yep.
Her friends started calling around to see where she was. They notified her boyfriend, her sister, and her mom. No one knew where she was. Somewhere during her 15-minute walk, she had just disappeared. Around 7:30, some local boys alerted Taylor's sister, Christy, that they had found Taylor's phone by the railroad tracks. Christy and Taylor's friends met up with the boys and recovered her phone a short time later and began to search the area, knowing that Taylor would never leave her phone behind. They notified the police, and those out on patrol began to keep an eye out for an 18-year-old girl dressed like a zombie, which I'm sure there were other kids dressed as zombies. That wouldn't have been an easy task on Halloween night.
Yeah. Well, and wouldn't, like, at the time of night, wouldn't there be other trick-or-treaters out?
Oh, there are. Yeah. And so they're just scanning through the kids trying to look for a zombie. At 8:45 that night, Colton and Zoe found Taylor lying face down in a ditch among bushes by the tracks. The left side of her head rested against a metal pipe. She was less than a kilometer from her house. She was alive, but having trouble breathing. Her friends knew that she was injured, but they couldn't really figure out exactly the extent of her injuries because all the real injuries were mixed in with all of her fake zombie ones.
Oh.
But it was very clear, though, that she was in trouble. Taylor's mom, Marie, raced to the scene, arriving around the same time as the first officer, and flagged him into the area where her daughter was, lying, struggling to breathe. Her friends and the officer laid their coats over Taylor in an effort to keep her warm and protect her as her mom grabbed hold of her, telling her over and over again, just fight it. You can make it. You're going to make it. You're going to survive. And I cannot imagine a mother going through this.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah. Just watching this scene would contribute to the PTSD that the officer would suffer later. More emergency personnel arrived around 9 p.m. and rushed Taylor to the local hospital, where she was soon transferred to the bigger hospital in Kelowna because of the extent of her injuries. From her injuries, the doctors treating her knew that what had happened to her wasn't an accident, and a trained sexual assault nurse was called in to collect evidence. There actually weren't any apparent signs of sexual assault, but with the way that she had been beaten, they weren't taking any chances on missing any possible evidence that could identify the dirtbag that had hurt Taylor. Taylor died later in the early morning hours of November 1st. Her injuries were just too catastrophic. She couldn't survive them. The autopsy revealed that Taylor had numerous injuries. She had a facial laceration around her right eye, a laceration and abrasions on her lower lip, and bruising inside her mouth from blows that she had received. There were scratches and bruising to her shoulder and defensive wounds on both hands, including two broken fingers. She had 6 5-centimeter long irregular lacerations to the back of her scalp with an underlying skull fracture. And it was surmised that each of these blows had been delivered by an elongated, heavy object, and based on their orientation, it was assumed that they were all delivered from the same position. So someone was standing over her.
Like a baseball bat or something?
Something similar. It's later found out that it was actually a big, huge flashlight. The pathologists at the time believed that any one of the blows would have knocked her unconscious, and the combination of all 6 were unsurvivable. Pieces of her fractured skull had broken into several smaller pieces, entering her brain and causing it to bleed from several different areas. There were also ligature marks around Taylor's neck. This is what the doctors had noticed while trying to save her life, and why the sexual assault nurse had been called in. The marks indicated that a smooth cord or similar object had been tightened around Taylor's neck, enough to cut off the blood flow, causing her to lose consciousness. But it was evident that Taylor had been conscious when the attacker had applied the ligature to strangle her. There were scratch marks along the marks. Taylor had fought against her attacker, trying to pull the ligature off of her. She had fought for her life. The samples that the nurse collected from under Taylor's fingernails would be Taylor's voice in catching the dirtbag Matt. As police investigated the crime scene, they found blood splattered on the ground and in the trees at the site, but very little else to go on. A newly deposited vodka bottle was found along the tracks, but when tested, revealed no DNA. Although this same bottle would be a source of a lot of talk and drama, as the officer first on the scene was accused of being the one to throw it away, and he was actually dismissed from his post. He would deny the accusations and later filed a lawsuit against the RCMP on how they handled the whole situation. While researching a case, there's always a little bit more to dig into, and this was one of those rabbit holes for me on this case. So many different people can be affected by a dirtbag's actions. And this whole situation was really sad, with the hint of a cover-up and some questionable aspects about the investigation. We actually had a listener reach out to us after this case aired on Buried Motives to say how the accusations had damaged both this officer and his wife, and both had left the detachment over the ordeal.
Yeah, I guess they would.
Yeah, unfortunate.
Yeah, it was really sad. During the investigation, police canvassed the neighborhood and learned that 2 distinctive screams were heard by neighbors shortly after 6, but they had been just chalked up to the unusual kind of antics that go on at Halloween night. Nobody had thought anything of them, really. And I'm sure on Halloween night, it's the last thing from anybody's mind that there's something as sinister as murder going on.
Yeah. And the perfect night to hide it, because like exactly, you said, you can be screaming, you can be walking around with blood on you, and nobody is going to be the wiser.
Yeah, it's just creepy that he used that as a disguise. Taylor's family and friends and the whole community of Armstrong mourned for Taylor, and they struggled to come to terms with what had happened in their sleepy little town. An unknown stranger had appeared out of nowhere and attacked one of their beloved children for apparently no reason at all. Most were in shock, thinking like nothing like this could ever happen in their small town. And there was a lot of fear that set in. And the fear only increased a week later after Taylor's death. When there appeared to be no other leads to follow, a letter was received by the police from someone claiming to be the killer and threatening further violence against women. Police weren't able to authenticate the letter because it lacked any specific details about Taylor's murder. But to be on the safe side, they did issue warnings to the people of Armstrong to be extra careful. If the letter was from the killer, who knew when he would strike again? If it was from some other sick individual seeking attention, then they actually had two deranged people wandering the streets. The mayor of the town issued a letter warning people not to walk outdoors at night and open the arena as a safe alternative for exercise. Projects to improve lighting around the town were started, but did little to subdue the fears of the townspeople, who were convinced that there was a killer among them. 3 weeks after the murder, police had their first big break in the case that would eventually point them towards Matt. The DNA that was collected from under Taylor's fingernails was a mix of hers and the killer's. She had been able to scratch Matt as he attacked her. Police now had something to work with. When they ran the DNA, though, the data bank didn't hit on a known individual, but it did hit on the DNA that had been collected from the Kelowna woman that Matt had attacked in 2005. This heightened the fear even more, because now they knew that they had a repeat offender on their hands that was escalating. Police at this point are desperate to find the dirtbag, and they pull out all the stops. They try to push the boundaries of the law and appeal to run familiar DNA. This would have allowed investigators to search for close partial matches in genetic databases. This, unfortunately, is not allowed in Canada, but it is being used in different countries. There is a lot of research that shows that crime often runs in families. One study conducted in the state showed that 30% of men in the prison system have brothers who are also incarcerated.
Interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
And we've covered several cases that are like that. I was thinking of your Rains case.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it just wasn't an option for them in this case. In Canada, it isn't allowed because of privacy laws, but RCMP representatives continue to lobby for the right to use familiar DNA in searches. Police connect with the previous victim and have her work with a sketch artist to draw a picture of her attacker, and then they post it everywhere, alerting media that this is the sketch of what the killer looked like 5 years ago. On November 23rd, police released the sketch to the public. Because the attacks were within relatively close proximity to each other over a five-year span, they believe that the murderer is a resident of the Okanagan Valley. The sketch they release is of a man that is described as a white man with darker skin, between 25 and 26 years old. Police say the suspect has brown eyes, short dark hair, and between 5'8 and 5'10 with a stocky build. He also has large, distinctive sideburns and thick eyebrows. They also give the public specific things to look for and behaviors that might help identify the killer. They appeal to the public, telling them that if someone somewhere knows something or had seen something that made them suspicious, they plead with them to come forward. The police note that the man responsible for killing Taylor might have come home after Halloween with scratches on his face and neck, and that they might have been experiencing social or financial problems leading up to the murder. And police say that he might have even acted strange or withdrawn from normal life afterwards. They are trying to jog anyone's memory in hopes of getting a lead. Police set up a tip line, which I'm sure after doing so many cases, Kim, you know that it's a lot of extra work and very rarely leads to big payoffs.
Right. Silly tips come in.
Yeah. But the people of the Okanagan stepped up in their fear and answered the call. The dedicated police officers waded through thousands of tips that were received and sifted out about 60 tips that were all about one man. One name just keeps coming up again and again, Matt Forrester. They were able to pull his cell phone records and show that he was in Armstrong at the time of Taylor's attack. And they began to question his family, friends, landlord, and former employers about his whereabouts. His landlord comes forward to tell police that he left his apartment in Lumbee quickly and very suspiciously right after Halloween. He had asked for his deposit back, but when the landlord had told him that it would take a few days, he just left without it. Despite their strong suspicion that they now are narrowing in on the right guy, police just can't find Matt to bring him in for questioning. By January 2012, after investigating him further, he becomes their primary focus. But as a suspect, he has just disappeared. By January 2012, investigators are focusing primarily on Matt and suspect that he has had someone to help him disappear. Can you guess who?
I think I have a pretty good idea.
Yeah, good old dad. When Matt had gone to his father after killing Taylor, Stephen, instead of encouraging his son to confess, helped him escape. Matt fled the province while Stephen lied and told people and the police that Matt had received a job offer to go work up north in the oil fields. Stephen had told police that the job promised to be a great opportunity for Matt. But the catch was, is that he had to leave immediately or else he would lose it. That's why he had fled so quickly. Mm-hmm. Stephen continued to tell that story to everyone to explain why Matt had left suddenly in early November. And it wasn't the end of his helping hand. Stephen gave Matt money to flee and paid $500 to a friend's nephew that was in need of some quick cash to borrow his identity. Stephen gave Matt Lee Shawcross's BCAA card, driver's license, an old bank card, and his social insurance number written down on a piece of paper. He even gave him stuffer receipts for the wallet that he had to be able to lie about his movements. Along with all this, he gave him a disposable cell phone to contact him in a way that couldn't be traced and laid out for him what he should do to get away with murder.
That's ridiculous.
Ah. The apple did not fall far from the tree. When Matt was on the road running from justice, Stephen stayed behind and arranged to clean up his son's apartment and store his belongings. In the 5 months after the murder, Matt began a whole new life in Ontario with the help of his dirtbag dad. Police were highly suspicious of Stephen's story about Matt working up north because there was no evidence of any job. They suspected that Stephen was helping to hide his son, so they applied for a warrant to secretly put surveillance on him and tap the pay-as-you-go phone that he had. In late March of 2012, they were able to intercept three calls that would give them Matt's location. On March 25th, police listened as Matt tells his dad about using his advice to switch numbers around on the social insurance number at his new job at a glass factory in Collingridge. And Stephen tells Matt that the cops are interviewing the family and that he's arranging for new paperwork so that he should drop the Shawcross identity soon. But he assures his son that the police, quote, don't know where you're at. The next day, the two talk again and discuss the price to pay for a new identity. And Matt promises that he'll pay his dad back. Just like any good son, right?
Yeah.
During this phone call, it is clear neither suspect that their conversation is being recorded. The third call was intercepted on April 3rd. In it, Matt tells his dad that he had gotten a new job as a painter because the manager at the glass factory noticed something wrong with the social insurance number he was using. And Stephen fills Matt in on the investigation heating up around their family. He tells Matt that he had to remove a tracking device from his mom's car. He also tells him that Lee has been talking about Matt using a new identity. They said that they should get rid of the cell phones, but then they kind of backtrack, saying if the police knew where Matt was, they'd already be there. Matt asked for his dad's house number, and Stephen said, quote, the last thing you want to do is call the phone at the house. Believe me, it's hotter than a firecracker. Police file an arrest warrant for both Matt and his dad, and on April 4th, both are taken into custody. Stephen at age... Oh, is that your birthday?
Yeah.
Well, what
Happy
a gift.
To me.
Yeah. Dirtbags off the street. Just yes. For Kim.
Yeah.
Stephen, at age 58, was arrested at his home in Cherryville and charged with obstruction of justice and accessory after the fact. While in custody, he admits to helping Matt and even that he knows it was wrong to hide him from the police to an undercover police officer. The undercover cop asked him why he didn't send his son to Mexico, and Stephen said he thought about it, but decided, quote, jails in Mexico would be worse for his son.
So that means he knew that his son would continue to offend, even in Mexico.
Oh, yeah. He knew his son was a dirtbag, and he knew he was putting people at risk by helping him get away.
But do you think he thought he was a dirtbag, or do you think he was just like, well, yeah, like, you know, like that's how you get girls. Like, you know, maybe he didn't even really think that what his son did was so bad. So he's like, wow, my poor boy, you know, we got to keep him from these people that just think he's a bad guy.
Maybe he was a dirtbag himself, but there are other family members that say things that make me believe that they knew he was doing these kind of things to women, mm-hmm. and that they were kind of brushing it under the rug, but they recognized that it was wrong.
Just cared more about their son than they did about the victims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they were too removed from them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Matt was arrested at Collingridge Motel, Much to the surprise to his new friends that he was making there. The Calling Ridge convenience store owner said that Matt regularly visited his shop to buy cigarettes beginning in December. Eerily, in his statement to the media, he says, quote, I've seen him with a couple of girls. One of these girls, a 22-year-old woman, a local bartender, had thought that Matt was a nice guy and considered him one of her friends. After the fact, she did say that there were things about him that she considered suspicious, like introducing himself as Matt at the bar, but then to other people as Zach, all the while he was using Lee Shawcross as his name at the Georgian Unemployment Agency. She was incredibly grateful that she had followed her gut and turned down Matt's invitation to go on a hike with him. She said, quote, just glad I didn't, because it would have been just the two of us.
Oh,
yeah. But she was also putting herself at risk by saying no in the first place, because he didn't take no for an answer. So I think she just got lucky all around.
It's true. It sounded like when he asked her out, they were surrounded by other people. And so he was inviting her to have some one-on-one time with her.
Oh, okay.
But you're right. She was definitely lucky that she escaped him.
Yeah. If Matt's urges would have surfaced again, this poor woman would have been his next victim. And his dirtbag dad knew full well the whole time that he was going to find another victim. Matt, at 26, was brought back to BC and charged with second-degree murder and five other charges, including sexual assault, unlawful confinement, break and enter, and assault with a weapon for his previous crimes in 2004 and 2005. On April 6th, Matt was interviewed for 7.5 hours by the RCMP. During the interview, Matt is emotional and at times sobbing as offers skillfully get him to tell them more and more, using every tactic available to them. At first, Matt gives little more than one-word answers. While admitting to feeling bad about killing, he doesn't share any details with the police. He is overly concerned about how everything will affect his family members and asks for them repeatedly. Police use this to their advantage and arrange for Matt to have some communication from both of his siblings. Unlike their dad, both try and convince Matt to do the right thing and fess up to what he has done. A recording from his sister is played, and she tells Matt that, quote, I love you very much, and you'll always be my big brother. Just be honest and do the right thing.
Good for them.
Yeah. It would be hard.
It would.
Yeah. His brother Mike is brought into the interrogation room and pleads with Matt to do the right thing, saying, quote, whatever happened hasn't just hurt our family, but other people too. He says, quote, what you can do is get some peace of mind. You know what I mean, trying to get him to confess. But something that he does say that is very interesting comes up in conversation between the two brothers. And it appears to me that he did have a previous knowledge of Matt's urges to dominate women. Mike says that he should have listened to Matt earlier and that Matt, quote, can't control this anymore. You're going to hurt more girls.
Oh, that does sound like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After talking to his brother, Matt begins to open up more about what occurred on Halloween night. The sergeant asks Matt, quote, am I right to say you're going for sex? And Matt replies, yeah, it just got out of hand. Matt's version of events taken from this interview and later interactions with his lawyers was that he was on a binge that day, and he had been for a while. From the time of his sexual assault in Kelowna, he had upped his drug addictions, adding mushrooms, ecstasy, and crack cocaine to the pot and alcohol that he had previously done. That summer, he had started to use drugs more and more. He said he even had tried to deal drugs, but instead consumed all of his product.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. On October 31st, 2011, he had been drinking vodka, smoking pot, and doing mushrooms most of the day. He said he traveled from Enderby to Armstrong in the late afternoon and decided that he should park his truck because maybe he wasn't safe enough to drive. He decided to take a walk around town to sober up. And around 6 p.m., he saw Taylor walking along the road near the tracks, and he started to follow her. He talked to her for a few minutes, trying to proposition her for sex. When she refused, he said he pushed her to the ground and just freaked out when Taylor started to scream. His version of the attack is very vague and disjointed, but he admits that he and Taylor had a, quote, scuffle that took them into the bushes where she was found, and that he hit Taylor with a sturdy metal flashlight an unknown amount of times. He also says that he tried choking her with his hands, but that she fought back, so he wrapped a shoelace around her throat. When she became unconscious, he fled, and later that night dumped the flashlight, his coat, and the shoelace in a dumpster in Vernon on his way back home. What is interesting about his version of events is that he talks about hitting her first, then choking her with his hands, and then using a shoelace. The evidence, while not conclusive, would suggest that he choked Taylor first and then attacked her with the flashlight because she wasn't moving when she was hit with the flashlight. And interestingly, the pathologist found no signs of bruising that would have been caused by his hands, just a shoelace. And who carries a spare shoelace around in their pocket?
Yeah, someone like him probably would, because you never know when some girl's going to say no, and I need to convince her.
Yeah. So to me, this just screams that this wasn't his third assault. He had done this numerous times to know to be prepared for any moment.
Yeah. And how terrifying for Taylor, like how terrifying, because it makes me sick actually when girls get, you know, you're just doing your thing and you get propositioned for sex. Like on what level does a guy think that, oh yeah, sure, no problem, let me take time out of my day to do something for you, this perfect stranger, and then to be met with that kind of rage for being disgusted by him and saying no is just, and how terrifying. The whole thing is terrifying.
It is. My heart just breaks for what she went through.
It's really sickening because it was clear that's not what she was walking down the street for. She was dressed as a zombie, ready to go trick-or-treating, which is such a pure thing to be doing.
That was her spirit, right? That she was just, and that she was just doing her own thing. Just leave her alone. Like it really bugs me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
And it just speaks to his selfishness, right? Yeah. He could not see past anyone but himself. That's just what he wanted in that moment.
And honestly, how many times does that work out for a guy?
Exactly.
To just see a girl on the street like, hey, you want to get it on? How many times are they going to be like, oh, I was hoping someone would ask me that today?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, the shoelace in his pocket is evidence to how many times it worked for him before.
Right.
Yeah. During his interview on April 6th, Matt makes several remorseful comments saying, quote, I was scared when I realized what I had done. I shouldn't have never been there. I just meant to keep her quiet. I didn't want it to happen like this. I feel terrible about how everything worked out since. I wish I could change it, turn back time, but I can't. I feel really bad for her and her family, how everything worked out. If I could, I'd take it all back.
It's really telling that he says, I feel really bad for everything that's happened since. Meaning he doesn't care that he killed her. He cares that he's been arrested.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. He goes on to talk about how, quote, I feel like I'm a good person. I'm just messed up. And sometimes I don't know what I'm doing until later. I know I have a problem, but spending years in jail isn't going to help.
Being on the street isn't helps either.
Yeah. Right?
Well, and even with the previous statement where he said, I feel bad how things turned out. Things didn't just turn out this way.
Yeah.
You caused them. You made these choices for this to happen.
Yeah. And actually, how remorseful can you be if you don't want to be held accountable? He goes right into saying, I'm sorry, but then making a whole bunch of excuses for his action and why they shouldn't be held and why he shouldn't be held accountable.
Yeah. And that jail's not going to fix them. Well, it probably won't. I would agree with that statement, but it's still like, it helps the rest of us. You need to be off this, like this guy needs to be away.
Yeah. From everyone.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
After the interview, in light of the new information that police gained during it, the murder charge against Matt was upgraded to first degree. Matt's Ford F-150 truck was taken in for processing and Taylor's blood was found in it on April 11th, 2012. So still years later.
Good.
Yeah. As the trials begin, the people of Cherryville were shocked and some were even defensive of the two of their own. Most of the animosity was towards the media and how they lumped the rest of the family in with this father-son dirtbag duo. Stephen was granted bail but was unable to raise the funds. When he finally appeared before court on May 7th, 2014, he pled guilty to his charges, saying, quote, I plead guilty so that they don't have to face a trial because they've suffered more than anyone should. Marie, Taylor's mother, said that it was, quote, a pathetic attempt at an apology, and said that she felt the only reason why he had pleaded guilty was because he couldn't afford the trial. Matt's case went to trial for the first time in March of 2014. The prosecution made a believable argument for first-degree murder, even though the defense argued that Taylor had hit her head on a piece of pipe on the ground.
So you're saying first trial, that means there's going to be a second.
Yes, and we'll get to that. This defense team's arguments were honestly so maddening. They did a lot of victim blaming.
Oh.
They're like, oh, they scuffled and she just hit her head on the pipe on the ground. And they talked over and over again about how she was dressed and what was she actually doing out on Halloween. She was too old. And
how she was dressed like a zombie as a provocative outfit.
Yeah, it was not a provocative costume in any way. It was a really, really sad defense. Thankfully, the jury of 8 men and 4 women saw right through them, and Matt Forrester was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life with the possibility of parole after 25 years. Outside the courtroom, Marie said at this time, quote, nothing will bring back my daughter, but at least justice was done. At least no other girl will meet the same fate she met, and we're just happy that the animal will be off the streets for a very long time. But like I said, that was the first trial. On appeal, the defense successfully argued that the judge had made 2 errors while instructing the jury that could have changed the outcome of the case, and Matt was granted the right to have a second trial 3 years later.
Oh.
Do we know what the mistakes were?
It was in the instructions that they had given him about, I can't remember off the top of my head.
But the instructions, something in the instructions.
It was something in the instructions to the jury. Shortly before the trial was started in spring of 2018, Matt, now at the age of 32, made a deal to plead guilty to second-degree murder and forego the trial. The lesser charge was agreed upon and allowed Matt to claim that he knew his actions would have killed Taylor, but he hadn't planned it in advance, and that he didn't fatally injure her while trying to sexually assault her.
Oh.
The element needed to prove a first-degree conviction. This just made me so mad, given his history and the fact that he had admitted during the first interrogation that he was after sex.
Proves that it her death happened directly as a result of a sexual assault. Like, that's first degree.
Yes. Yeah. It's so maddening. During his sentencing, he was unable to meet anyone's eye as he read from a piece of paper, quote, I am sorry that I have taken your loved one away from you all. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't feel regret. I hope in time you will be able to move forward with your lives and one day find peace. Again, Marie spoke out against the emptiness of this apology and pointed out that Matt hadn't even said Taylor's name.
Yeah, they never do. And those little, when I love it when they pull out their little pieces of paper that are always, you know, they're written by the lawyer.
Yes.
They're not heartfelt at all.
Mm-mm.
Marie went on to say that, quote, I don't think he feels remorse. I don't think that they should let anyone out who still poses a threat to society, particularly women. Women shouldn't have to walk around afraid. And she's agreed. Right.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. Matt's expression of remorse only came after being caught. He had fled for 5 months. And during that time, he had lived a life, a similar pattern, drinking and trying to pick up women. He hadn't changed at all. So he was not remorseful.
No.
On June 5th, 2018, after hearing victim impact statements, the judge agreed to the sentence agreed upon by both the prosecution and the defense, a life sentence with no eligibility for parole for 17 years. So in the end, it ended up that he got 8 years off of his parole time.
Yeah.
For pleading. Matt also received 6 additional years, though, for each of his other attacks on the other women. They are both being served concurrently with his murder sentence. Matthew Forrester will be eligible for parole on April 4th, 2029, at the age of 43.
Oh.
But there is actually a clause that would allow him to apply in 2027. But I think it's unlikely that he would be granted it. But we've seen crazier things happen.
That's too soon. And he would still be so young that he could have decades of wreaking havoc on more women.
And we know with sexual offenders, they're very, very rarely reformed.
No. And they tend to get married while they're in prison too, which always just blows my mind that anyone's
Yes.
willing to even correspond with them, let alone marry them.
Right?
Knowingly, like knowing that they are a sexual predator. It's so crazy to us too, Kim. During Matt's time in prison, so far, he has been described as.
A model prisoner. Yes. I hate that. I hate that
It's because there's
phrase.
no women there for him to attack.
Right. And he's probably being protected.
So awful. He has been taking part in rehabilitative programs, and his last known location was the medium security prison in Abbotsford, BC. His only known difficulties were mentioned in his father's court's proceedings. Matt had been the target of an attack in prison, and his father, who was incarcerated at the same prison, defended him against the assault by throwing coffee at the inmate's face.
Of course he
Both
did.
Matt and the other inmate were burned to the point of blisters.
Abbotsford is where Dustin is right now.
Is it?
Yeah, Dustin Duffy, he
Wow.
got transferred to medium security. I guess they only have to spend, I think it's the first 3 years in max security before they can get moved. And he's not a model prisoner either. They don't, it's the whole thing, medium security is ridiculous, but whatever.
It
The
is.
classification system and how they define these model prisoners is just so crazy to me. But I thought, when are this guy's father instincts to protect going to let go? Like, even in prison, he's still trying to protect his son.
I mean, I love my kids too, but I mean, I know that the instinct when, like, when my kids were little and the say my son would get into like a scrap on the playground or whatever, my instinct would be like, well, he must have been provoked. Somebody must have been doing, but to cover it up, like you're risking your own freedom to do that. Like, there's certain things that I don't think you can cover for your kids.
Right.
No, especially when it puts other people at risk.
Exactly.
And at this time, this wasn't like with Taylor's case, it wasn't a case of Stephen thinking, oh, somebody's accusing my son of doing something and I don't think he did it. Matt went to his father and told him he did it. So there was no guessing what he was covering up. Stephen has now served his sentence and has been released. His marriage has fallen apart since the charges. She just couldn't stand by him. In 2013, a 185-meter memorial trail was opened along the tracks in Armstrong, where Taylor was walking that fateful night. The idea was Christie's. The path was created by the Van Deest family with the help of the city and the Kelowna Pacific Railway, and of course, the community that was always so supportive. Along the path, lighting was a huge priority for them. The trail is adorned with figurines, and at the halfway point, there's a gazebo with benches and a collage of pictures of Taylor's. It's a really pretty sight to visit. And that is the case of the sniveling little boy of a man, the perverted dirtbag, Matthew Forrester, and his meddling criminal father.
So many different things to think about in that case, like just even from the Halloween thing, like to your point about how you can just commit these horrible crimes at a time when it's so easy to conceal it. Like that's scary. It ruins Halloween for me.
Right?
Yes. And the letter sent to the police a week after her death just made me feel sick to my stomach. If he had sent it or if somebody else had sent it, that is
And
just
whoever sent
disturbing.
it. Yeah.
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 He would never admit that he sent it, but he didn't admit to much.
No, it wasn't his fault, right? It was all an accident.
That's how it turned out.
Yeah.
Oh, crazy.
Well, we hope it turns out that he does not get parole in these few years coming up. No, this
Yeah.
is one dirtbag that needs to stay in prison for a very long time.
Oh yeah. I mean, he's got Ted Bundy vibes, right? Oh, what a scary case. Well, I really appreciate you guys telling me that one. I knew there was a Halloween Canadian case, and it was a really interesting one, and it's just so, I don't know. It just makes me mad that women and girls that we just can't live our lives without being afraid of people like this.
Right. And we questioned what we're wearing, even in a zombie costume.
Yeah, that's disgusting to me. Like,
it
really
is. But we appreciate you having us on.
Yes, I really appreciate you guys coming on again. Like I said, so we both started our podcast right in this. It was August of, was it 2021? So it's been 3 years, right?
3 years. Yeah. Right around the same time. So we've been in the trenches together.
I really enjoy the research, and I just get myself pulled into these rabbit holes, and I wind up, my whole life is nothing but research now. So
yes, that's how I find it.
Yep. Research, show notes, editing, repeat.
Yeah. Are you surprised at how well it's taken off? Like we're in Canada, it's different, right? We have a smaller audience to pull from initially. So it's really hard to get discovered. So I'm always surprised when people find me. You guys have a fairly big following in some other countries too. And you're like, well, how do people know about me? You know, like,
it is shocking sometimes.
Yeah. Cause Canada, our US is our biggest following by far. More than half of our listeners are US and then Canada, but then like the UK and Australia are right up there, which is kind of shocking.
Yeah. I think they like their true crime there. I'm glad that we have done this again and to reconnect. And my sister always tells me every time I mention you guys, she goes, oh, I love those guys. I listen all the time ever since you guys covered Taylor's case and she discovered you. So you're one of her favorites.
That's very sweet of her.
We appreciate it. We do talk about you sometimes on our podcast when we're talking about how they could have made a million other choices. We do give you a shout out just like Kim says on her podcast.
Yeah. My new tagline is everyone you know is capable of murdering you.
I say that. It's so true.
It's so scary.
It is.
That's one thing I've learned is anyone can kill you. Yep. You think your grandma's not going to? She could.
Under the right circumstances, right motive.
The right grandma.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, and I'm much more suspicious of people. Like even going for a walk, I'll see some guy working in his garage and I'm like, what's he got in there?
Yeah.
What's he doing?
Yeah, those garages.
Right?
And the white van.
Yeah, what's in your freezer, sir?
Save big on your next project right now at Menards. Save time on your paint project with help from Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape. Use on walls, trim, glass, wood, or metal for clean removal and clean paint lines every time. Save big and get a 3-pack of Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape on sale now through September 22nd. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.